I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
James Morrow's new book, The Last Witchfinder, is narrated not by a person, but by another book, Isaac Newton's Principia Mathematica. The story is tough to distill in a neat paragraph, but I'll try. It's about Janet Stern, the daughter of a professional witchfinder who's determined to use science to discredit witchcraft after her beloved aunt's execution for Satanism. The story begins in England, then moves to Massachusetts, site of the Salem witch trials, and then to Philadelphia, where Janet goes on trial. It's also where she falls for Benjamin Franklin. Janet Maslin, writing about James Morrow in the New York Times, said this: "Mr. Morrow is a very odd bird, a novelist of intellect, bravado, and phantasmagorical imagination. In his previous books," she goes on to say, "he has fused satire, philosophy, and science fiction, and has, among other things, envisioned a literal godhead the size of Delaware." This is James Morrow's ninth novel. He spent some 7 years writing and rewriting it. He lives in State College and joins us here in Philadelphia. Nice to have you with us on the program. Good morning.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you here. I was reading that this book actually began some 20 years ago. You ran across a sentence in a book by physicist Edward Harrison. The book was entitled Masks of the Universe. What was that sentence?
That's right. The book argues that science can never give us the universe with a capital U. Instead, as history progresses, one universe with a lowercase u replaces the next. And for Edward Harrison, the Renaissance was the witch universe. You know, we think of the Renaissance as a flowering of humanism and the arts, which it was, but it was also an absolutely crazy time. It was a deranged interlude between the sane universe of the Middle Ages and modernity, which some people would say is also sane, or at least it's the age of science. And Edward Harrison said that were it not for the arrival of science, the enterprise of persecuting witches would have destroyed European society. And I said to myself, my God, there's a theme for a novel. What a great subject. A civilization's near self-destruction at the hands of its own theology.
And that's a perfect idea for a James Morrow novel.
Well, I like to take on large,
I know
large
you do.
Premises, yes.
But this was 20 years ago. Where did that idea go?
Well, I guess it just percolated in the back of my brain. I wasn't really ready to attempt an historical novel. It's daunting. Technically, an historical novel is an impossible medium because you never can learn all the details of your chosen era. And then one day I said, okay, the time is right. I'm gonna try to tell this huge story of the rotation from the Renaissance to the Enlightenment. I think the breakthrough was when I realized that the main character could live through it if she were born around 1678. I always knew the main character must be a woman.
Huh.
Women endured a disproportionate amount of the persecution at that time. And I said, okay, she'll live through it, and to some degree she'll make it happen. She will try to bring down these statutes that legitimized the burning and hanging of witches.
Well, I'm intrigued that you wanted a book to narrate this, and that may, for people that haven't read the book, that might sound kind of clunky. I have to say it works. I don't exactly know why, but why did you want a book to narrate a book?
Well, I did have to feel my way into it, and it's a little precious, I will admit. But as you might have inferred by now, and your listeners as well, the novel's a celebration of the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty keen on reason, and I'm a contrarian vis-a-vis organized religion. At the same time, I didn't want to seem like a mindless cheerleader for rationality. I wanted to demonstrate that I had some perspective And so the Principia as narrator was a way to periodically offer some commentary and sort of put the events in context. Also, I guess a pet peeve of mine is historical novels in which the characters are very, very conscious of the significance of the events that they're living through. And by having a kind of disembodied, omniscient narrator floating around between the chapters, I was able to supply that kind of awareness without the characters doing it.
And for people that haven't kept up with or even remembered what Isaac Newton was saying in this book, before we get a reading from your new book, I wonder if you could just help us understand why his book was so important, and it was so important, and so pivotal at this particular time.
The Principia Mathematica has justifiably been called the greatest work of science ever written. And it kicks off a new understanding of reality. Ironically, perhaps, from the point of view of Newton's shade, because he was himself perhaps the most pious man who ever lived. Nevertheless, since the Principia, God is no longer seen as the ground of reality. For scientists, God's on the back burner. It's not at all an atheist position, but it's a secular position. It's saying nature operates as a function of laws, not as a function of continual intervention by angels or, in terms of my book, continual intervention by demons. And that truth, if you will, is Janet's life's mission. She's desperate to tell the world this fact that Newton's discovered, because it will save lives.
Well, I want to quickly reintroduce you, and then I do want to have you read from the very beginning of your new book, and that's James Morrow, our guest today on Radio Times, and he's got a new book. It's called The Last Witchfinder, and he joins us today on Radio Times. Well, with that set up, let's hear from the very beginning of your new novel.
Okay, here we go. Chapter the first. May I speak candidly, fleshling, one rational creature to another, myself a book and you a reader? Even if the literature of confession leaves you cold, even if you are among those who wish that Rousseau had never bared his soul and Augustine never mislaid his shame, you would do well to lend me a fraction of your life. I am Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, after all. In my native tongue, Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, the Principia for short. Not some 10th grade algebra text or guide to improving your golf swing. Attend my adventures, and you may, Dame Fortune willing, begin to look upon the world anew. Unlike you humans, a book always remembers its moment of conception. My father, the illustrious Isaac Newton, having abandoned his studies at Trinity College to escape the Great Plague of 1665, was spending the summer at his mother's farm in Woolsthorpe. An orchard grew beside the house. Staring contemplatively through his bedroom window, Newton watched an apple fall free of its tree, driven by that strange arrangement we have agreed to call gravity. In a leap of intuition, he imagined the apple not simply as falling to the ground, but as striving for the very center of the earth. This fruit, he divined, bore a relationship to its planet analogous to that enjoyed by the moon. Gravitation, ergo, was universal. The laws that governed terrestrial acceleration also ruled the heavens, as below, so above. My father never took a woman to his bed. And yet the rush of pleasure he experienced on that sweltering July afternoon easily eclipsed the common run of orgasm. 22 years later, in midsummer of 1687, I was born. Being a book, a patchwork thing of leather and dreams, ink and inspiration, I have always counted scholars among my friends, poets among my heroes, and glue among my gods. But what am I like in the particular? How is the Principia Mathematica different from all other books? My historical import is beyond debate. I am quite simply the single greatest work of science ever written. My practical utility is indisputable. Whatever you may think of Mars probes, moon landings, orbiting satellites, steam turbines, power looms, the Industrial Revolution, or the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, none of these things is possible without me. But the curious among you also want to know about my psychic essence. You want to know about my soul.
A book with an ego.
Indeed,
I like
yes.
that.
this book has an attitude, and he's by no means synonymous with his father, Newton.
Well, first of all, that's a great reading, and I thank you for that. And I wonder, even as I was both reading and then listening to you read from your own book, how much, even as a writer, you sort of have to polish each word as it comes out. I'm not saying it sounds like that, but do you labor over each word?
That's the whole fun of it for me. I don't remember to whom to credit this maxim, but it goes as follows. I don't like to write. I like to have written. And once I've, faced the white bull, as Hemingway put it, you know, the blank sheet of paper, or today the blank, you know, phosphorus screen with the dancing dots, we writers can then fight our way through the first draft. Okay. Once I've got the first draft of a chapter, then I'm in heaven. Then comes the ecstasy, sitting in a coffee shop with a printout and engaging in the process you're talking about, Marty, polishing, honing, searching for le mot juste, as Flaubert put it, you know, getting the right word, if possible, within the domain of reality. I mean, at a certain point, you need groceries, so you turn the book in to your publisher.
But the hard part for you, or the grueling part, is that first draft, getting that first draft on paper.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's.
I guess knowing it's imperfect, right? Or it's not in any way.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, done. You know, the medium of the novel is perfectible. So, it's why so many of us really don't want to give it up, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think Thomas Wolfe was famous for having to be, like, visited by agents from Maxwell Perkins' office to which, like, appropriate the manuscript and take it down to Scribner's and publish it, because, you know, he was still polishing the darn thing. But yeah, for me, it's I know you were just speaking to Lawrence Fishburne, who's produced a movie, which I'm anxious to see. I used to make films, and I never enjoyed the process of being on the set. It was chaotic. I was never getting, never getting the material that my imagination was seeing. But then, once I had something in the can, then I could sit down in the cutting room and make something happen. So for me, writing fiction is analogous to making films.
Like the editing process.
Yeah, this grueling process of getting something on the page, but then the fun starts with the editing.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation with our guest, James Morrow. He's a novelist, and he's got a new novel. It's called The Last Witchfinder, and parts of it take place in England and Massachusetts and here in Philadelphia. There's also a scene where Benjamin Franklin is in the sack with the heroine of The Last Witchfinder. And James Morrow joins us to talk about witch hunting in the age of reason, and also to talk about his approach to writing. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This fall, all New Jersey high school athletes will face mandatory drug testing for steroid use. We'll look at the increase in steroid use among teens and how that's affecting high school athletics. We'll hear from the U.S. Drug Czar's office about the state of drug use among teenagers. Are anti-drug ads effective in stopping teens from doing drugs? Drugs and drug testing in America's high schools, this week on Justice Talking.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Ed Gordon. On News and Notes, we bring you the events that shape our lives and the voices that change the way we look at the world. From Cecily Tyson to Queen Latifah, Bishop Desmond Tutu to Barack Obama.
The biggest mistake people in elected office make is trying to be something they're not.
Join me for a new take on the news, News and Notes from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
After serving as the first woman priest in an Episcopal church in a small town in Georgia, Barbara Brown Taylor resigned from parish ministry to teach religion. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the political and spiritual reasons why. Her book is called Leaving Church, A Memoir of Faith. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, James Morrow is our guest. He's got a new novel out. He calls it a pseudo-historical novel, and it's called The Last Witchfinder, and it's about many things, including Janet Stern and a young woman in her quest to overturn the Parliamentary Witchcraft Act of 1604. And that was an actual act, and there's nothing fictitious about this act.
Yeah, it goes on the books under King James the First, and it's actually the act under which the Salem witch trials here in the United States were prosecuted. And in my novel, I hypothesize the final witch trial in the American colonies in Manayunk, not too far from this studio, occurring around 1731, and that would have been legitimized by the Parliamentary Witchcraft Act of 1604. So that gives the novel its plot. Here's a woman trying to destroy a law, and it is the case historically that it remained on the books until about 1735. So my heroine, born in 1678, just devotes her life to bringing down this statute. It's a very personal quest for her because she's seen her beloved aunt, who taught her science and who loved her, burned at the stake in Colchester, England, for presumed
Satanism
compaction
or something.
with the devil, exactly.
Yeah. And Janet's father is a professional witch
finder.
Yeah,
it's kind of the family's trade, and he is the son of an obscure but actual witch finder, John Stern, who rode the countryside with Matthew Hopkins, who was a famous English witch finder of the Civil War era. So she has to make a break with her father's trade, with her father's way of looking at the world. You know, I mean, the underlying theme of the novel is that, you know, the whole universe changes at this time in history. The Renaissance world picture disintegrates, and it's replaced for better or worse by today's scientific worldview. Her brother, by contrast, Dunstan, remains true to the family's calling, and he is, in fact, the last witchfinder of the title.
Well, and it's interesting to think that back in these times, there were, I guess, pseudoscientific ways that the people who believed in witchcraft believed that you could scientifically or actually prove that someone was a witch by looking at certain behaviors or looking at the way someone would, a woman, you know, would act. If she'd been accused of being a witch, then if she acted in a certain way, that was then proof that she was a witch.
Yeah, exactly, Marty. That is what was so fascinating to me about this era and why, you know, after 20 years, I said, okay, Jim, go for it. Try to write this magnum opus. Because during the era, this enterprise of arresting women, putting them on trial for supposedly compacting with Satan, signing the devil's books, and then executing them, it was not seen as incompatible with the emerging natural philosophy, as science was called in those days. It took a subsequent generation to notice the incompatibility, because there's a pseudoscience. There's a kind of false logic about the tests. You drop a woman, you tie her up, and you drop her in a river. Okay. Well, pure running water, the medium of baptism, wants no truck with a Satanist. So this water will eject her. In other words, she will float. This is called swimming the witch.
Right. And this was proof, actually done.
This was actually done more so in England and on the continent than in the Salem adventure. But you know, you can see there's a kind of logic. There's a logic to it. Pure water hates witches. Sometimes, of course, in the course of being proved innocent, the woman would drown if she sank. You're supposed to tie a rope to her. A witch was supposedly incapable of reciting the Lord's Prayer without making a mistake. The witch was presumably given a familiar, a pet, a cat or a toad or some other creature, and at the same time, Satan would provide her with a nipple, an extra teat with which to suckle. To suckle this impish, demonic little animal, and so the witch finder would inspect the woman's flesh, would strip her and search every square inch of her body for one of these excrescences. There's a kind of logic to it.
Well, there's also perversity to it. You have a scene in your book of one of these witch finders. I mean, examining every cavity in this woman, looking for evidence that she was a witch.
Yeah, you can't help wondering if there was another agenda.
Well,
going
exactly.
On, sort of, prurient interest.
The idea that you could strip a woman and examine
her
body.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, there's a whole feminist interpretation to this, to the burning times. Mm-hmm. My interest was more in the theological problem.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a feminist novel. I mean, it's about a woman who almost single-handedly brings down this witchcraft act of 1604. Nobody knows for sure why it went off the books. The records of the speeches that were made in Parliament at the time are lost, so I had room to maneuver.
You actually brought her to Philadelphia, to where she, in a sense, puts herself on trial, or makes sure that she ends up on trial.
Yeah, yeah. I imagine the last witch trial in colonial America occurring around 1731, and there's even a little bit of grounding for that in that one of Ben Franklin's many hoax articles is an account of a witch trial in Mount Holly, New Jersey, you know, across the Delaware.
And he wrote a lot of hoax articles.
He wrote many yeah. hoaxes. But this one, I seized upon this and said, okay, let me take Ben at his word. There really was a witch trial in colonial Philadelphia in 1730. And Jennett can use it as a platform to tell the world about this new picture of reality. She can tell the world about Newton. She can tell the world about her own treatise that she has written. And I imagine it as a kind of media circus, you know, sort of the first media circus in America, because Ben is publishing the Pennsylvania Gazette at the time, and it has a pretty wide readership. And I imagine people just, you know, waiting for the next edition to find out what happened at the trial in Manayunk.
Well, you also imagine them in the sack together. And you have a wonderful setup where you make the transition from, the electricity that, of course, Benjamin Franklin is famous for experimenting mm-hmm. with, and some transferring that electricity to the electricity between these two characters.
Yeah, there's lots of sparks fly between them. He shows her how to generate static electricity with one of these sulfur balls that you spin and you touch, and then before too long, some erotic sparks are flying between these two characters. They're of different generations. I mean, Janet's now middle-aged, and this is the young and rather randy 18-year-old Ben Franklin. But you know, Ben had a lifelong appreciation of older women.
Apparently,
one of his amusing pieces is called "Advice on Selecting a Mistress," and his conclusion for his readers is, you know, pick an older woman. They have more knowledge of the world. They'll give you a better conversation in addition to having all kinds of experiences, carnal and otherwise. So I would say that my novel,
you took him at his word,
accounts for it, explains why Ben had this deep appreciation of the older sort of paramour.
Well, let's get another reading, and this is a paragraph where they meet.
They've just had their sort of experiment with sulfur and sex, and now there's a kind of afterglow. They've learned that they're in love with each other. As twilight came to Philadelphia, the philosophers lavished themselves on one another, abandoning the bedclothes only to stoke the fire or appease their bladders. Whenever Ben was occupied with hearth or chamber pot, Janet took to indulging in salacious speculation, and ere long she'd accumulated musings enough that, if so inclined, she could write a book addressing the mystic qualities of carnal embrace. Swiving, she decided. Swiving is, you can imagine. Swiving, she decided, was no less spiritual an exercise than the singing of a hymn or the recitation of a prayer, a truth that might very well explain the clerical zeal for witch cleansing. For how could the immense and sprawling Christian church, with its instinctive suspicion of human bodies, its profound Pauline hope that these soggy conglomerations of leaking cocks and dribbling quims might simply disappear one day, how could it abide the possibility of widows and wenches and all manner of seductresses turning their devotional energies to sybaritic congress, those notorious orgiastic sabbats? A woman needn't worship Lucifer to spark a demonologist's ire. She need only be made of flesh.
That's James Morrow reading another selection from his new book, a novel called The Last Witchfinder. And he joins us today on Radio Times, 1-888-477-9499. Now, in this book, Benjamin Franklin and Isaac Newton actually meet.
Yes, that's
did that ever happen in their actual lives?
They almost met. This is my first historical novel, and much to my delight, I found that there was just all of these pieces of actual history lying around like jewels in a field, and I could come along and string them together into a necklace. And one of those jewels is the fact that in 1725. Benjamin Franklin, the young Benjamin Franklin, is in London on a commission from the Pennsylvania governor, supposedly to acquire some printing equipment, and he's desperate to meet Newton. Newton is now a celebrity, and he has a kind of letter of introduction through a physician named Pemberton. The meeting never came off, evidently. Hmm. I mean,
did
you
Newton
know,
want to see Benjamin Franklin?
I think Newton's attitude was probably, so this cheeky kid from Philadelphia wants to waste my afternoon. I want none of this. However, in The Last Witchfinder, they do meet. I found myself using Newton and Franklin as symbols, I guess, of this transition from revelation to reason. You know, Newton, the avatar of the Renaissance man. You know, this very, very pious, eccentrically pious individual, and then of course the skeptical, free-thinking Franklin. So when they actually meet. The reader comes to understand they don't simply come from different generations and two different continents. They really come from two different universes. They have nothing to say to each other. They just talk past each other.
So all this buildup nothing to talk about. I was reading that you grew up in a family that was Benjamin Franklin Ophiles. Would that be a fair description?
Well, my grandfather, who lived with us for many years until he died, was a lithographer. And, Ben Franklin is the patron saint of printers and lithographers. And, as an avocation, my grandfather made watercolors. And one of them was a portrait of Franklin. So it hung in our living room for many years. So, I think I grew up in a house that was kind of suffused by the benevolent ghost of Ben.
And you grew up around Philadelphia.
And this is happening in the Philadelphia suburb of Roslyn. And I ended up matriculating at the University of Pennsylvania, the college that Ben founded. So I went into the research predisposed to like Ben and came away admiring him even more.
Is that right? And Philadelphia's been celebrating his 300th birthday this year.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't time the book for that. But I like to think that it's that my novel is now part of that celebration, because he was such a remarkable man, and you know, we need more of him now, I think. You know, he was so rational and yet so passionate at the same time. You know, he was the one founding father who stood just four square against the slave trade. You know, it's very hard to find any dirty laundry in the Franklin biographies. As I say, you know, I wish he was. I wish he was in charge of our republic at the moment.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I have to say, reading the novel, I couldn't help but think about the time we live in today, and we're still in this conflict over, you know, this age of reason and science and superstition. I'm not going to exactly call it witchcraft, because there are people who are witches who, I think that's a whole other discussion, but this notion of superstition on one hand, that seems very, very...
It is timely. As I said, the novel was, the first draft existed prior to September 11th, but that sort of threw into relief that tragedy, the whole problem of theocracy, I guess, you know, that impulse to... I don't know, think that you're reading God's blog, you know, that you know exactly what the divine intends, which, you know, I regard as arrogant in the extreme. I'm afraid we find a strain of that in the Bush administration. I mean, we have this irony of the moment of, you know, Mr. Bush saying, well, they should teach intelligent design, and you know, let's not have stem cell research, that's blasphemous. You know, and at the same time, you know, so the, almost a qualified enthusiasm for theocracy coming from Washington, at the same time, they're hoping against hope that something resembling a kind of neo-enlightenment secular government will emerge in Iraq. Mm. And, you know, I think that's for me, a painful irony, even though it might help book sales.
But I wonder whether, I wouldn't exactly call this book science fiction, but I wonder whether your kind of writing then allows you to explore some of these big issues, and what you just described is a big issue. I wonder whether it's something that also human beings have gone back and forth through our evolution between the sort of rational worldview and one that's sort of built on magic and mysticism and, as you say, and theology.
Yeah, it's hard to know where we're going, and certainly one of the reasons I wrote the novel was to celebrate the Enlightenment, because that just isn't done. Mm. You know, I mean, the religious right detests the Enlightenment because it leads to Darwin. In postmodern academia, there are all these fancy arguments about science as simply a narrative, and the Enlightenment as the source of a technocracy that is in turn repressive and murderous. And you know, on the New Age, there's you know, a wariness of reason, which is seen as somehow ipso facto more shallow than cosmic awareness. So the Enlightenment it has few friends.
You're one of them, though, right?
And I certainly sign up for it. As I said earlier, the Principia narrator, and you mentioned, you know, sort of the freedom that this quasi science fiction conceit brings to the book. The Principia, you know, clarifies that there's a case to be made against reason, especially the deification of reason.
And we're going to take a very short break and get back to our guest, James Morrow. He's got a new book. It's his ninth novel, and it's called The Last Witchfinder. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Philadelphia moves forward to the next mayoral election. How will surrounding areas be affected? What issues concern the entire region? How will the future of Philadelphia help determine the future of the entire Delaware Valley? The Next Mayor, a groundbreaking multimedia project to explore the issues leading to the Philadelphia mayoral election. Your issues, your voice. Presented by WHYY, the Daily News, and the Committee of 70. To learn more, visit thenextmayor.org.
next time on Day to Day.
So we good? We got another appointment?
Selwyn Smith left his home after Hurricane Katrina, and he is still trying to figure out how to move back a year later.
We haven't even gotten to the point where we could even start over yet. We still dealing with the stuff that happened a year ago.
Are the dollars for Katrina relief going where they're needed most? We follow the money with the first in a series of special reports next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
What do your friends mean to you?
I think friendship's very important, as I believe it helps define you as a person.
Most of my friends have a good sense of humor and just people that enhance your quality of life.
I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll hear about a new book that discusses the state of friendship in America. That's today at noon, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, our guest is James Morrow. He's got a new novel out. It's called The Last Witchfinder, and it's a fictional tale of a woman who makes it her life's mission to bring down the Parliamentary Witchcraft Statute of 1604 in England. But that mission takes her also to Massachusetts and here to Philadelphia and allows our guests to talk about interesting large issues about the age of reason and about superstition. And he's the author of several other books, including City of Truth and Towing Jehovah. He lives in State College, Pennsylvania. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Since this book is narrated by another book, the Principia Mathematica, I wonder whether this book was also about a fight with another book called Malleus Maleficarum, which is the book that was used to try to hunt down witches.
Yes, it was the Witch Hunter's. It was the Witch Hunter's manual. It was produced by two Dominican friars, Kramer and Sprengler, and they were sort of like the Lewis and Clark, I guess, of demonology. They went through Northern Europe gathering evidence of supposed satanic compact, and everywhere they looked, they found a witch, and they wrote this manual on how to detect a witch and what procedures you should use. So it was another one of these ways of giving sort of the outward appearance of legality and the outward appearance of rationality to something that's really nothing more than cruel and cannot be defended at any level.
Do you know what, if anything, James Newton felt about the Malleus Maleficarum?
Newton didn't have much to say about demonology.
Isaac Newton, excuse me. I knew James wasn't right. Go ahead.
I found a passing comment in one of his letters, I think it was, saying that he thought demons were desires of the mind. That is, that they were simply human fantasies. And so I leaped on that like a duck on a June bug and said, okay, I can make my heroine obsessed with decoding the Newton's masterwork, the Principia Mathematica, decoding it in a way that will yield this definitive disproof of demons. Other of Newton's colleagues, though, kind of lined up with demonology. As I say, this is a crazy time, and these beliefs that we now call superstition were for many members of the Royal Society completely consistent with the experiments they were doing with gases and acceleration. Robert Boyle of Boyle's Law of Fame, which we all had to study in high school chemistry, thought that there was one particular case, the demon of Macon, a town in France, had cinched it. You know, there absolutely is a satanic intervention happening. You know, it as I said, it took another generation. But Newton, as always, was, I guess, ahead of his time, and he was skeptical.
I get the feeling you love doing research for a novel like this.
Actually, I hate doing research, but
you like talking about it.
Yeah, I love what I've learned. You know, it's frightening to open. I mean, I'm kind of still doing it. Before I showed up at the studio, I was in near, you know, Convention Center, and they have all this wonderful some Ben Franklin murals, and I was still kind of in research mode, and I'm saying, oh, I'll bet there's some facts here I can cram into the book. No, too late. maybe I'll write a sequel.
You have called yourself, and I was just ran across this as we were doing our research on you, a scientific humanist.
Yeah, that's a fair label. You know, there's a convenient dichotomy that I think is floated too often between science, which is seen as a cold and unhuman enterprise, you know, and the arts and the more intuitive ways of being in the world. I think that's malarkey, as the late Carl Sagan, who was a hero of mine. Carl Sagan used to say that, you know, biology and chemistry, physics, they're every bit as much humanities. They are the humanities as much as literature and art are humanities. Science is, it's a human creation, but relative to an assumption that there's an external reality and that some of these natural laws are knowable. And that they have their own integrity. They're not being driven by angels or demons.
Are you also an atheist?
Well, that's not my favorite word. Okay. I'm an atheist. I resist the word just because, you know, it defines only a void or a lack, or it points to a black hole. I think for secular humanists, we feel that our way of being in the world fills us up. It's glorious. You subtract the God hypothesis, and wonderful things rush in to fill the gap. You know, my children, my love of the arts, and so on. I love a quote by the philosopher Galen Strawson, who says, God loves the atheists best because they're the ones who take him the most seriously.
Oh.
So here I am, technically an atheist. If you woke me up in the middle of the night and said, are you an atheist, Jim? I would say, yes, I'm an atheist.
When your defenses were down,
yeah,
right?
But I also think, you know, God put me here to be an atheist. You know what I mean? To make that case, you know? I think it's good for us.
Boy, I'm still trying to digest that question, how God could put an atheist on planet to question God.
I like paradox. You know, novelists aren't obligated to be totally consistent.
But were you raised in a – I don't want to harp on this too long, but yeah. Were you raised in a religious family and then you just sort of moved away from religion?
The atheist strain in my fiction, I don't think is a reaction to my upbringing. My parents were kind of, I guess, very low-key believers, and they took me to this sort of white Protestant church in Willow Grove in northern Philly. I think they had this sort of inoculation theory, you know, better give the kid a little bit of religion or, you know, he might come home one day and announce that he's decided to become a monk. But I lost even the little bit of theism that the Presbyterian Church of Willow Grove imparted to me. I think when you're a Presbyterian, there's really nothing much to lapse from. You know, it's not like being a lapsed Catholic, which is kind of an ordeal, I gather, for former believers. Yeah.
I also read that it was a high school literature class that you took. I guess a world literature class that sort of opened you up to the world of ideas and books and maybe even writing.
Yeah, it was a marvelous experience, and I would not be in this radio studio today if it was not for James Giordano's World Literature class, 10th grade at Abington Senior High School.
Really?
He showed us what a novel is or what a novel can be, you know, this sort of matrix of ideas. It's not just a story. It's not just vicarious involvement in the lives of characters. It's a whole argument about life and its mystery and the fact that we're thrown here and we don't know what we're doing here. Most of the books we read were contrarian. I absorbed the notion of the novelist as somebody who sort of tries to stand apart from received wisdom and critiques it. So we read, it seems remarkable in retrospect. I don't think 10th graders are exposed to this kind of literature. Voltaire's Candide, for example, you know, which is a blistering critique of l'enfant, as Voltaire put it, you know, the ecclesiastical order of his day. We read Camus, you know, The Stranger, you know, now there's,
sure.
You know, The Honest Atheist, you know, someone whose atheism is hard won and kind of anguished. We read the plays of Ibsen, you know, supreme skeptic who had no use for conventional ideas. So I said, that's what I want to do someday. I want to write satiric books or dramatic books that make these kind of arguments at the same time that they're entertaining and engaging.
Was this teacher known as being a teacher that could turn kids on, or was it something about you and the chemistry with him in the books?
This was his first year, I think, and like many first-year teachers, he was just a ball of fire. You know, he loved fiction so much, and actually, my novel called *Blameless in Abaddon* immortalizes him, or at least uses him as a character, Mr. Giannasio. I changed his name slightly from Giordano, and I have him, you know, teaching the Brothers Karamazov to. Well, I made it 12th graders because nobody would believe 10th graders, and I called him up shortly after the book was out and just to thank him. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, he's in poor health. That's why I'm always going to defend the public schools. My heroes are public school teachers.
And that one teacher can turn someone into a writer. One teacher just turned
my life around, opened up a whole universe. So I've ended up writing a novel about people having universes opened up to them.
Do you think of yourself, though, as a science fiction writer?
That's another label. Like atheist, which can get a conversation started, but I wouldn't want it to stop there. Science fiction's been pretty good to me, given me a couple of awards, approximation of a living wage, something of a captive audience. But I don't see science fiction as like a medium of artistic expression. It's sort of a category that tells the bookseller where to shelve the book in the store, you know.
Well, I ran across a quote from you, and this is talking about science fiction. You said, and this was an interview somewhere, on one level, science fiction seems to me religion by other means. It's community, particularly the conventional infrastructure. There's an element of transcendent. Even the most scientifically oriented works have that sense of wonder, sense of awe.
Yeah, I was talking earlier about my admiration for Carl Sagan, and I just think the point can't be made too often that science does not foreclose the possibility of awe, you know. And I think I understand what Darwin was up to, and this notion of animals as participating in these grand algorithms that change their structure over time. And yet we've got some cardinals building a nest outside our window in State College, and I just weep. I'm so moved by that, and I think my Darwinian perspective does not deprive me of a relationship with those birds, and I'm just in awe of it, and for their own sake, you know. Maybe God has something to do with it. I don't know, but I just think those birds are so remarkable, and we don't know what it's like to be a cardinal, but something's going on there, and it matters.
Well, this is maybe another category, but I'll toss it out anyway. Do you think of yourself as a satirist?
Oh yeah. Which is, I suppose I should say that with some reservations, you know, the famous line about concerning theater, that satire is what closes on Saturday night. And there's always a danger with satire of becoming kind of a preacher, you know.
Yes.
And, you know, telling the reader a thing or two that is good for the reader. So I try to avoid that trap. But on the other hand, I do think I have a thing or two to tell the reader that's good for the reader. And, regard humor as, valuable for its own sake, also a kind of Trojan horse for getting my ideas inside the skull of the reader. You know, if the reader is entertained and then I can slip in some of my irreverence, so much the better.
But the idea of Trojan horse, so you sort of under the guise of something else, you pull in an idea and then hit them with something else.
Yeah, no, I'm not into. I mean, I greatly admire, say, the Douglas Adams Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series, but I see those books not as satires. They're just sort of, they're larks. They're lampoons. He's just having a barrel of fun with all of the conventions of science fiction. But I have an agenda. I'm grinding many an axe, most of them having to do with organized religion, and some of them having to do with just this dichotomy between reason and feeling, which I think is a false dichotomy.
Some people have described a satirist as an angry moralist.
I think being angry helps and staying angry helps. I think that's different from bitterness. You know, I think there's a kind of creative anger that's on the page here. No doubt about it. A few books back, I blew up the world, a novel called This is the Way the World Ends, about a nuclear holocaust. And the critics said, this is a very, very angry book. And nolo contendere, it was. I was terrified and furious at the way the world's leaders had arranged to hold us all hostage to nuclear weapons. And so I tried to make a contribution to the protest.
And by writing writing
the novel.
But do you think of novels as protest, or some of your novels or parts of your novels as protest?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think even in this media-saturated age when everybody's playing video games and looking at DVDs, novels still sort of convene conversations and give us a vocabulary for talking about, you know, what they're doing to us. And if you look at the even very recent, relatively recent novels, 1984, Catch 22, Orwell, Joseph Heller, they gave us a vocabulary for expressing our anger and for understanding what is being done to us. So that 1984, you know, and has entered the dictionary, not just as the title of the book, but as a definitive critique of totalitarianism. You know, not simply obvious fascism, but the totalitarian thinking that intellectuals in the West have periodically been transfixed by. Catch-22 enters the dictionary, you know, and the novel can still do that, I think, in a way that movies and music does not.
Well, James Morrow, I've thoroughly enjoyed talking with you, and I thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're very welcome. I had a great time.
Me too. And the book is called The Last Witchfinder, and our guest has written 8 previous books. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can leave us an email there about the program. Devorah Lissick, Alan Tu, and Susan Greenbaum produced the program. Al Banks, our engineer for today's edition of the program. I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, and worldwide at whyy.org.